You're listening to the Coach Team Podcast, a podcast with Swedish Basketball Federation's basketball developer, Rickard Aspgren and Andrew Plake. In today's episode, we will talk to Mike McKay, who is Performance Manager, Women's High Performance at Canada Basketball.
During your time as coach or developer, what are the biggest changes you've made?
One was just the whole idea of the long-term athlete development model. And I'm not 100% that the model is a perfect science. It is not a perfect science. But it does recognize that there's different stages that athletes go through.
Okay.
That's the most important part of it, that recognizing that a 12-year-old is not the same as a 17-year-old, who's not the same as a 3. That's, as long as you start to recognize that, you're understanding long-term athlete development. The second piece is, it's not a straight, perfect pathway. Mm-hmm. It's not this straight line to success. And if you do this, do this, do this, you'll guarantee that. That is not in the long-term athlete development model, but some people sometimes think it is. Mm-hmm. So to me, it's just understanding context, which is always who plus why equals what plus how. So who are you coaching and why are they there before we get into the what's in the house? Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing I'll ask. Well, who do you coach? Why do they play? Are they playing to be a pro? Are they playing just for fun? Are they playing to get away from the stresses on the street? what's the reason? And then you can now talk about the what's in the house after. So that was the biggest thing, I think, was just getting long-term athlete development in. Mm-hmm. There's some pseudosciences in there too that I don't agree with. The second part was the whole idea of loading or a games approach to coaching. Okay. I think that was big, and I will credit two Italian coaches. One was Mario De Sisti, who we had come over in, I think it was 2005, one of my first years. And he showed us some stuff that was like, wow, I know nothing about mm-hmm. basketball. Man, he just taught the game through decision making. Mm-hmm. And that was just huge. And then we have Renato Pasquale come in around 2009-10. And he worked with our senior team, but he also put together some stuff for us all, and a lot of it was around, again, loading. Mm-hmm. And the thing about Renato was, he said to me, like, I traveled across the country for 2 weeks doing the same clinic, but we got so good with it, and we built our whole curriculum around it. But he said to me, Mike, he says, my son isn't playing basketball now because of the way I coached. Yeah. And that was heartbreaking.
That is tough.
And he said, I realized I had to come up with a different way to coach to make it fun for my son, who's no longer playing, but for, you know, and that's what he wanted to do. And it was all, again, through loading. And we developed this whole idea of loading drills, which I think has really helped our coaches at a beginning level understand what that challenge skill.
Can you explain a little bit what loads mean?
Well, we talk a lot about, first of all, there's the mental, the physical, the cognitive load. Let's just talk the basketball loads. So we talk about a phase A. I don't usually use those letters anymore, but the first load is really on air, which we don't use a lot. There is a time for it, but there's no defense, right? So that would be a very simple load. We use phase A mostly for warming up and a little bit of cooling down. Sometimes with younger players, to wobble. Go try it on your own. Go figure it out, the footwork for a layup. Just go figure it out. They don't need a defender there. Or just go shoot. Just figure this out for yourself. With senior players, you can do a little on air because they can visualize defense. But if you take a younger player and you're inbounding, doing an inbounds play, they have no idea where the defense is. They can't picture it. As soon as you put the defense, it's a whole new play. And I even challenged with our senior team. I remember we were in Tenerife and we put in an inbounds play on air. And then as soon as we ran it against defense, it didn't work. And the coaches were like, this is ridiculous. We just spent 5 minutes working on it. And I said to them after when we debriefed, I said, well, but you never showed them where to screen. So they were going up again and just screening air, which is exactly what they did on the They never set a screen on anybody yet. Well, they should know that. I go, you would assume they would, but I said, because of the way the defense was playing, they weren't they were sagged off. Mm-hmm. So they didn't really, they thought they were just supposed to go to where their person was, because that's what they practiced for 5 minutes. So, I mean, even with seniors sometimes. So that's phase A. There's another part of phase A where you can start to put in what we call scripted defenders. And that's what I use a lot. So a scripted defender, or you could be doing it the other way, a scripted offense where I'm working on defense. Where scripted is, it's like they follow the script. They're a pylon with arms and legs and can move, but they're following the script. So when I put in a play with my junior academy or an inbounds or something, we have a scripted defense. This is what you're actually doing. So at least they see, you know, when we say no deflections, let the passes go through. Okay? Or it might be scripted till the ball's reversed, now we play live. And I did a scripted with them on the weekend. I did one where we're going to get the ball reversed through just seals and get open, and then we're live on the other side. Okay? Or we go scripted to this shot, and then we're playing. So it's kind of on air because the defense isn't really live, but it's a way to at least have to get better transfer. A phase B is where we now get into decision-making a little more, where it's guided defense. And guided means is the defense is either doing A or B. Either they're going to deny or they're going to sag. They're going to play on your left or your right. They're going to have hands up or hands down. And now you've got to make the right decision based on what you see. So it's very important, though, that you give an accurate guide. Too often I see players give these terrible guides, so the player's not seeing the cue that they need the cue. What's the word in the constraint-led approach? There must be an action coupling, action, right. Cue. Yeah. They got to be coupled
perception
together.
Coupling.
Perception. Yeah. They got to see what their action is, or they got to see the cue to make the right response or action. So we're very big, and a lot of times coaches end up doing all the guys. You got to teach your players how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it takes a little more time, but once they learn, man, it helps grow their intelligence too. The next level is where we start talking about the compete level, and now we start to put more pressure. How much pressure? Are we going to be in sag? Are we going to be up? Are we actually going to be bumping a little bit? So now we up the intensity to a little more game, and then there's game-like, which would be phase D. So we just say in a drill, okay, we're live, this is live. And when we say live, the players know. Like, it's live. It's like a referee. You don't stop, you play inbound. Okay, if it's guided, here's the options. If it's intensity, okay, in this drill for right now, we're playing sag. Okay, right now, no. You're going, and you actually can reach for the ball. No, we're just playing shock. Okay, we're playing hand pressure. Like, we can dictate. Mm-hmm.
And it, so your loads are often, or almost always, according to the defense?
No, we can do the same thing on the offense. If I'm working on, what I will say,
let's say the opponent.
The opponent. Right. If I'm working on my offense,
yeah.
I'm probably spending more time coaching the defense.
Right. But I'm saying the loads are according to the opponent.
If I'm working on my defense, I'm loading my offense. So the offense, okay, you're just stationary. Remember I was doing the shooting drill. You're stationary, you can go in and out. Okay, now you can exchange. Now you're allowed one dribble to try attack middle. Okay, now you can set screens. So I constrain the offense also, if I'm really focusing on my defense, to get the load that I want on my offense, or the challenge that they have to come up with solutions.
And do you use this on all age group?
Every age group. Every age group. It's like in every practice we do, every drill we do. Every drill we do has a load. And it's just constantly you're thinking about your load. And that's why I say it's not so for 2 minutes we do this and then another two. It's more like, okay, we've got 10 minutes. Here's what we think we're going to start our load at. But ideally, here's the challenge we're trying to get to. We want to be better at reversing the ball against ball pressure.
And how do you like when you see something that you think is wrong? How do you do that?
So sometimes you got to let them play through it, right? But if in my metacognition, remember my planning was, let's say it's passing versus pressure. And one of the big challenges we have is players exposing the ball, not protecting the ball.
Yeah.
And not doing what we call a space pivot. At the beginning level, there's nothing wrong with stopping and deloading. And we may go right back to a rip to practice just for like 30 seconds. Let's just all practice our space pivot. Boom, boom, boom. Okay, let's go back. I don't have time sometimes for them to discover on their own by me inventing some new game and not, like just show them for 30 seconds a space pivot and now see if that transfers back. And I know the purists sometimes, well, you're not really constraint-led. And I'm like, I don't believe anything is 100% theories are true. I don't think. Do I teach everything that way? No. But in this case, I need them to see this solution. Mm-hmm. Second thing is I can change some of the rules. So the simplest one for me is just you call them violation. It's just the violation, right? That's the negative reward, which is goes against, you know, transformational coaching because you're making a transaction. But that's part of the game. No, no space pivot. Turnover, other team's ball, play, they'll learn. Another one, though, is I call it, I kind of got this one from Alex Cerama, but I call it the Harry Potter, but I got to come up with a new one because not as many people know Harry Potter.
It's funny you say that because we had the super clinic, he was here, and he did the Harry Potter, and the kids looked at him kind of confused, and, yeah. and we reflected on that afterwards, like he might have to come up with something.
But I have a golden snitch. You know what the golden snitch is?
Yeah, yeah.
And Quidditch? I actually have a golden snitch. I have two of them, and I have it at practice.
But maybe you can have like a book circle or something like that in the team, so they read Harry Potter books and.
Well, it's just a matter of finding something that the players like. I'm big on these little awards that. So I have an ice award, like every IC who gets the best for intensity, who gets the best for concentration, best for energy for their junior academy, who wins, and the players at the end, remember I said spotlight, so they get the spotlight, who's the most intense player and why, and you gotta be very specific, who had the best concentration, who gave the best energy, and it's big for those players too. It's like, so this year I'm actually getting some little, at these, found these at this craft show, these little blocks of wood, really nice different woods, and all I'm doing is putting the can of basketball sticker on them. And then I'll put intensity on them. And, you know, you get to keep that. So just a little, but I think those are big. That's that praise.
Yeah.
So going back to this whole idea of the Harry Potter Award was, it's in Quidditch, when you catch the golden snitch, game's over. So to me, if our point of emphasis is use of space pivots, and I may say something like, if your team, if everybody on the team gets one space pivot, you win the golden snitch. And all I do with the little kids is, as soon as somebody, their team wins, we all run over and do a selfie. Like, ding, golden snitch, boom, play again. Takes 30 seconds. But man, they remember. And they'll be like, space pivot, come on, Andrew, you need a space pivot. Come on, Andrew, because they know if he does it, they win the golden snitch.
Right.
So that's with little kids, fun. I even think that older players get a kick out of that.
They would love
too.
That. Right? I know I would if I was there.
Right? So it's just, how do I bring your focus to the right thing at the right time? So that's a big part of in the drill is me having, again, remember I said that clear picture what it's going to look like, sound like, or feel like. And then trying to find creative ways to get them, for them to put their attention on it and not letting them just fall back into old habits. The biggest problem I see a lot of coaches is they have this great drill set up. The drill starts and then they stand there and they let the player self-organize. And they have no idea how to manipulate what's happening in the drill except get frustrated. Or else, good job, way to go, good job. Or they just, again, it's just, oh, good shot, oh, unlucky, they got it.
I think it's a good quote from Rob Gray, the science podcaster. Yeah. He says something like knowing what's next, that's good coaching. And I think a lot of things in that, like what happened on the floor and like, what will I do next as a coach?
And that's again, that's that planning piece, having a visual picture of what I'm expecting to see. But also being open to that wonderment of, wow, whoa, look at that. Mm. Never thought of that. And praise that. Hey, that was a great solution. Yeah, let's think about that. Because you think of the great inventions in basketball. It wasn't a coach. All of a sudden, the one-handed jump shot, that was no coach. In fact, coaches were telling them not to shoot it. You keep shooting with two hands staying on the floor. Don't be pulling in this one-handed jump shot shot. We're not having any of that on my team. But then all of a sudden it worked. So what happened? Now coaches tried to teach it, but they taught it wrong because they tried to teach the one-handed jump shot the same way people shot with two hands, which was what? Shoulders perfectly square, feet perfectly square. That's how you shot with two hands. They didn't realize when you shot with one hand, what happened? One shoulder was closer to the basket than the other. And so for 30, 40 years, we've lived with this idea of shooting with our shoulders square because that's how coaches taught it, but that's not what players did. You think that all these fancy passes were invented by a coach one day in practice deciding that, hey, when we penetrate, we're going to let them jump out of bounds and throw these hook passes? The first time a guy did that in practice, not on my team you're doing that anymore. Mm. But luckily, a player like, say, a Steve Nash got on a team where a coach at Santa Barbara allowed him some leeway, right? Or Seth Curry's coach Davison allowed him to shoot some deep threes, right?
And how do you know? Because this is something me and Andrew talk a lot about. Like, is there a baseline for shooting example? Is there like okay, you can go this, but not this way. Like,
well,
you know, those frames.
What we use, and this is in our coach education piece, is the principles of movement. And basically, there's five principles of movement. And I think they're pretty solid. That's in every shot and every pass, every dribble, everything you do. And the first one is your ready position or your preliminary action. So what are you doing to get ready to shoot? So there's some things that are pretty universal. Like, you better be facing the ball. Like, you can't have your back to the ball if they're passing to you. So let's say it's a shot off the pass. So you need to be like relaxed and ready in a ready position. Now, do you have to be really bent down deep? No, you're thinking of a perfect model now. And everybody's may look a little bit different, but there has to be something that you're doing. The next thing is on that preliminary action, are you going to be a pivot shooter, a hop shooter, or a 1-2? Those are usually the three things. They all work, and I can find you pros who do all three. But what one works for you, and it's going to depend on, is it 5 feet from the basket or a deep three? It may be different what you do. Are you a 10-year-old girl or are you a 7'4" male playing for Cape Verde, like who I was watching last night, right? Like, who are you? It's going to be different what your preliminary action is, but you have a preliminary action. The next part is your backswing. You have to have a backswing. That's how the human body works. It works off elasticity. And if you want to be explosive movement, now the people can't see it here, but if I put my hand on my chest and I want to move this finger fast, if I take away the backswing, so I said, okay, I'm going to eliminate the backswing. Now, push as fast. Wow, that's like fast. No, it isn't. Now put the backswing. They can hear the backswing. They can't hear the backswing in that. And that's what a lot of coaches have done, is they told us to get down in this position like this and now shoot. Well, there's no backswing. It's slow. It's like pushing a squat. We're not squatting. We want explosive elastic energy. So we need that down up. And that's where we've coached the backswing over a lot of shooters, especially in their upper body. A young female player can't shoot from up here from very far, because she's going to get to this position and she says, okay, coaches now tell me I got to get it to that basket, which is 10 feet up and are now 18 feet away. Okay, the only way I know how to do this is get backswing. So then they'll do this. They'll drop it into their shoulder like a shot put. And as soon as they drop it in the shoulder, because that's your backswing, that's your reaction. That it's right. And they're going to shoot it out flat and they're going to be a front rim shooter. Just guaranteed. Not that you can't. There's some pretty good shooters who can shoot with a flat shot. But as soon as you put a defender on, now if Andrew's that close, I'd never shoot. So we need to get them to have something that is going out the top of their cylinder with some snap and energy. Okay, so yeah, that's getting closer to a certain type of shot. Then there's that force generation, and it's the force generation going up through, because that's what we're trying to do. And then is there a critical instance when the ball leaves your hand? All I know is it's up here somewhere. Your critical instance can't be down here. And it can't be a different, it can't be one time it's my little finger, one time it's my thumb, one time. It's got to be consistent. And then there's a follow through. So preliminary action, backswing, force generation, critical instance, follow through. That's in everything you do. That's on a dribble, that's on a pass, that's on running. Is there one perfect way it looks? No, there isn't. But it's a one that's for every shot you take. No, every foul shot's different. Everything's different. So it's helping players discover what works best for them. And that's how we do shooting with our elite players.
If you feel then that maybe something they do are like constraining them, do you like say, oh, maybe can you try to change your hand? Or
if we find that what they're doing is not working, and what working means is consistently giving them we call it a Brad and a Rob. Those are your two best friends. Rob is, you're in your range, you're open, and you're on balance. So if you can't shoot a Rob shot, there's something happening. And usually for most of these players, it's their range for girls. It's because they've been given a shot form that doesn't work to develop enough power for them to get the ball to the back of the rim. And a Brad is a back rim and down. And the science tells you, if you shoot a shot with a proper arc and get it to the back rim and go straight down, that is the best shot by science for percentages. So if you're a straight line, no miss left and right, and you're consistently hitting back rim. So we had a young lady in Madrid at the U19s. She was 0 for 11 in a game against, I can't remember, I think it was against Spain on threes. But every single one of her misses was what? Back rim and up. And we probably got 8 of the 11 rebounds because they were great. They're great shots. Not once did we say, don't shoot the ball anymore, because they were great shots. And by the way, she made the shot in overtime that basically won the game. Like, and it was back rim and straight down, like just bang, perfect shot. Because she's a great shooter, because they're back rim and down, back rim and down. But they just went back rim and bounced up. But if she's missing left, right, air ball, that's the ones that are tricky. As long as they're getting robs, they got good range open on a bounce, and they're getting brads, I'm not changing anything. Usually there's something in there, though. And mostly for the, it's the power generation for the young girls. It's, they've been taught to do this one, right? Pause from here, and now shoot with this elbow under, this perfect form. That's just impossible to get a
so you're not, so, like, form shooting is just not your best friend?
No. A form shooting with all five components in it, backswing, force generation, like, very rarely do I go to one little part. I think with any implement, your grip is important. So if you're a golfer and you have a bad grip, you're a tennis player, badminton player, you have a bad grip, it's going to be because you need to transfer the energy through that implement. Well, same thing. If you have a bad grip, so you're holding a ball like this, I've got to break that down on a little bit of form.
And
I've
on this, he meant on top of the fingers, yeah. Hands not on the ball.
That's right. There's something I got to – but I had a player one time. I said, oh, we got to fix your grip. Well, literally your thumb looked like that. It came out – like it was just literally this tiny little thumb was like that. And I'm like, no – you're going to keep shooting with two hands like that, because she couldn't balance it.
She couldn't open her hand up.
So she needed this, and you know what? She became a pretty good shooter. But if I had tried saying, no, you have to just do all this with one hand, like there was no way she was going to shoot. Right. Her hand wasn't big enough. You know, that's just, you know, she was a tiny little girl with a small hand, and we were playing back then. We were still playing with a size, what, 7? I don't even know what the size of the ball is.
I think that is really interesting, because I think we've talked a lot about this, about generating power.
Yeah.
You know, as long as they're generating power and identifying where they're losing power, where they're losing energy. I think coaches too often look at the results of the shot and say, well, it didn't go in, it did go in, instead of looking at, okay, well, what are we lacking? Where are we losing the energy? Like, is it in the lower body? Is it the hips that we're not hinging? Are we not,
it's form not creating over function, that? Or is it function over form?
Yeah.
Steph Curry, it's function. It's not form.
Right.
Damian Lillard, it's function. It's like a lot of these guys shooting floaters now, and some of these three, it has nothing to do with form. All the purists are kind of like, oh, that's a terrible shot. No, it's not, because it works. And I think the more that we're looking at the function of what it is, I need to get the power from this spot at this tempo because of the way the defense is playing, and get it up over the rim in a straight line. That's what I need to do.
Right.
That's the function of what my shot needs to do. It's not that it has to look absolutely perfect, right? Because there's a lot of perfect shooters that just can't shoot.
If you hear like NBA skilled coaches and so on, they talk a lot about like forms before function.
Yeah, but also they gotta have to guarantee their job too. Like they gotta sell their shtick, right? Like if I'm telling you that you don't really need me, you can just go shoot. Yeah, so, yeah. Well, what's he going to do? You're going to spend a lot of time working on little things. And it probably doesn't hurt the guy.
No.
But is it the best thing? We don't know that. So, again, these people say, well, you should never do on air and all this stuff. Well, I'm saying, look, if I'm a kid and I get in the gym on my own, oh, I'm not going to shoot because I'm not supposed to do any on-air practice? Come on. You're telling me all these people that learn to be great shooters, they get in the gym on their own. But they also challenge themselves with unique little games, right? Because it gets boring just to do this. So the coach who said, everybody's got to go in and shoot 100 shots or 500 shots every day. I don't think that's the best way to develop a shooter. I think it's more important that they went in with intent on something mm-hmm. that they were focusing on. I'm working on my backswing, getting backswing from different angles. I'm working on getting my force generation through a high release point by having something I got to shoot over, up through, right? I'm working on landing on a good balance, safe follow through. Whatever it is, there's some intent on what I'm working on. Instead of just, I got my 500 shots. Yeah, the gun says I always this many percent today. Same pass, same shot every time. instead of being more creative and challenging myself in different things. And that's what Steph Curry, that like a great shooter gets bored with just shooting the same shot. So that's why he does a lot of these. If you ever watch him in a warm up, high ones, low ones. Steve Nash was the same. Off 1 foot, high, low release, you know, backboard. Like just challenging yourself.
Yeah.
Right? And making it more deliberate and intentional. The other thing is we've taken some of our shooters and put them on force plates. That's an amazing thing to do.
And explain what a force plate is.
Force plate was we our physiologist, sports scientist, she uses force plates a lot for in weight training to see when a player does a lift, is she have an imbalance, like pushes more to her right or left side, and we try to get them have same balance. Same with jump landing, all our vertical jump tests we do off a force plate, are they pushing? So I just said one day, well, can I have them shoot jump shots off the force plate? Well, the problem was the force plate was too small and they couldn't. So we built, the guy was great. He built a platform that's about as big as this, but a square with the four plates in it. So now they could do their hop into it, their 0-1-2 step in it or whatever, you know, they could get in, catch a pass and go up and shoot off it. But wow, it really showed us, because what you see is who's putting the force into the floor. And of course, whoever put the best force into the floor was getting what? The best force coming off the floor. And we could see, were they pushing off 1 foot or the other? Were they landing safe on all on one leg? But also the players start to understand their shots. They start to understand, oh, when I did this. And it wasn't like a hop shooter. These ones who kind of do like this big hop, it was these quick little slide hops, boom. And just that quick little hop, that was more explosive than this big deliberate, that, and then when they absorbed all the hop, that's not explosive. So it really, really helped them.
Interesting.
Understand. It helped me understand that, okay, it's getting that quick energy into the floor. And then it was also the stiffness, like in Canada, hockey stick. If I have a stiff hockey blade and I take a slap shot, if I can get that stick to bend, the power of my shot, same as in golf, right? A stiff club. I can't hit stiff golf clubs. I'm not strong enough. But if I'm too whippy in my golf club or my hockey stick, it doesn't give me energy back. But it's the same thing in jumping. Great, quick jumpers don't bend and absorb a lot. It's quick. It's quick through the ankles. We had Milt Ottley, he was a very famous Canadian high jumper, come in town and work with our jumping for shooting. I mean, the guy was 48 years old, and he was just doing ankle jumps. And he's like, and I'm just like, holy smokes. And it was just these ankle jumps, bang. And I go, okay, that's what we got to do.
Yeah.
You know, but we just relate jumping and we think, oh, it's this deep jump, bend your leg. And the problem is sometimes our physios will say, oh, we got to be safe. We got to absorb when you land and bend properly. And yeah, on that kind of jump. But we're talking ankle jumps for quick, explosive shooting.
Right.
So again, that's my short, long version. But you're right. Like, we spent a lot of time on the IPPs of shooting. So those junior academy players, that's one of the first weekends we do that. And then we're constantly, throughout the entire set, we're always working with them on their shooting.
Can you explain a bit the IPP? What's that and how
individual,
you work with it?
Individual performance plans. So for every player, we have our gold medal model, which is, you know, basically there's the four pillars. There's the physical pillar, the mental pillar, social-emotional pillar, and the basketball pillar. And we test in the physical. We do some stuff in the social-emotional. We do some stuff in the mental and the basketball. But on the basketball one, shooting is always in everybody's IPP. And we do that. We do their analysis of the shot, and then we try to help them understand what their shot is, like your shot identity, like who, what is your strength and what's your limiting factor. And then we try to enhance your strength, and we try to reduce your limiting factor. So your anchor is in the storm, which is the last 2 minutes of the World Cup or the Olympics, and you got this shot, you're taking it and making it because, baby, that's my shot. I'm making it. Well, you know the other team is going to take that away. Well, what do we do to enhance that? So if you're a deep corner three, that's your shot. Well, can you now slide when they try to run you off it? Can you slide and still get your three? Because they're not letting you get that one anymore. So you got to keep enhancing it, right? Your limiting factor is, I don't finish at the rim. Okay? So they basically run you off the line and give you a wide open layup, and you got to be able to go in there without, like, who's going to block it. That's your limiting factor, so we got to work on that too. For the players, we will pick an anchor, like your identity, what's your strength, and we're not talking the shooting now. What is the skill usually or part of your game? And what's your limiting factor? What's keeping you from getting on the floor in the storm? A coach says, no, we can't have Richard on the floor now. He can't be on the floor now. Like, got to get him off. So they can't say that. And then we develop what's going to look like, sound like, and feel like, right? What, when you go, okay, so how are you going to be training that? And so the next time we see them, we can say, hey, I can see that you've been working on your IPP. And that's what we track them on. Just the one, so it's really three things, right? Their strength, their limiting factor, and their shot. Then they'd have something on the physical too, like, so it's their endurance, their strength, whatever. Okay, but that's what it is. Same thing for coaches. I picked something for the coaches. So we do a little survey, help them discover what's your anchor, okay? How do we keep enhancing it? What's your limiting factor as a coach? How do we grow that? So let's say a coach, one of the coaches was, one of our female coaches was, she wanted to present more confidence in the storm. She felt she got quiet in the storm, and the players interpreted as, in her opinion, the players interpreted as lack of confidence. So she wanted to work on that. So I said, okay, what are you going to be doing? Well, she wanted to try to simulate what she's doing when it's earlier in the game, not get quiet. So we had to go back. Okay, what are you doing? What are you saying? And what are you showing? What's your body language? What's your tone? And then she worked on it. And then we would track it. We would video her. She could then debrief. She worked on it and got better at it. So to me, everybody in our organization has to have an IPP.
Do you involve the player when you build it with, like...
Oh, yeah. It has to be the player involvement. They've got to own it. First thing is you sit down with them and you go through a process. What's your strength? What's your identity? Who are you? Right? And get them to describe themselves. And what do you think you... And then just keep build on that for me. Go deeper.
And how do you do, like... Because I a little bit test this model in a youth team I have. And, like, when I talk to them, I ask them. Maybe some say that, yeah, my defense, that's my strength. And, like, from my perspective, that's the weakness of this player. How do you address that?
So that's where you have to use questioning and get into build. So let's use the example of defense. So first of all, I would say, is that defense on the ball or defense off the ball? On the ball? And if they use upspeak, there's upspeak, then you know you got them, that they're thinking. Okay, so on the ball. Is it the dribbler or the stationary player? Or is it in the post? What's your evidence? Give me a role model. Who do you guard on the other team when we play? Do you guard their best post defender? You said your post defense is your best. Who do you end up guarding? Well, I always guard the other team's wing player. Why don't you guard the post player? Well, Billy's a better. So already we're starting to understand that you're not probably their best post defender. So just by questioning and keep going deeper, I can get them to realize that maybe they're using false evidence. Because most of them say, I'm a good shooter. Okay, from three, from two, off the dribble. Are you a good shooter in the clutch? Like when we need to make a shot late in shot clock, are you the guy we're going to? Well, no, we don't do that. Okay. What's your shooting percentage? Yeah, so usually you can get them to understand, but especially with guys, because with guys sometimes they all think they're one step from the NBA. Or with girls, and this is just generalization, where girls think that everybody's, I'm not as good. If I have one weakness, then I'm no good. Whereas guys, like if I do one of the 20 things, I'm a superstar. I can, so you just have to keep helping them. And then, to be honest, sometimes you just got to think, this is the one you need because this is what the team needs you to do right now. And this is what the scouts for the universities are saying, that if you don't get better at this, because maybe dad is telling me you're a great shooter, but the scouts are saying, if he can't do this, he's never going to play. So it's just a matter of having those discussions with the player, but also having some evidence. And, what's Rasheed Wallace's? Ball don't lie. So, pull the video out, pull the stats out sometimes, right, and show them. And it's amazing what they see watching a video, what you see. Because they just, I never noticed that. Oh, I never thought of that.
But do you, like focus them in a role? This will be your role, or?
Younger players don't get too hung up on roles. When you get in a national team, that's a big part of it. I'm sorry, that's just, you have to... Your role, there's no player except maybe one on the national teams who goes through every phase of basketball, and the role is that I get to make a lot of mistakes and stay on the floor. there might be one player within our national team who's gotten to do that, and I don't even know who it is, because it just doesn't happen, because there's somebody else who's just as good ready to go in. And if you don't accept your role, so you're not going to be able to go out there and shoot the shot every time you get the ball. Like, a high school kid may take 25 shots. You're not walking on the national team taking 25 shots. You may get four, and they better be good ones. And it's always amazing. Your first game you play with, say, like the U16s, they all think they're going to get the same role that they had with their team. They do, their parents do, and their coaches all think that's going to happen. And after their first game, the number of emails you get and phone calls and text messages you get, well, why didn't they do? She normally with us? It's not the same context. I've told you this. We prepared you. And most of the players start to realize, oh, yeah, okay, I understand why I'm now not playing 20 minutes, and I guess, you know, pretty good players here. But there's always one or two who their parents or their coach doesn't get it. And, yeah, I'm going to have to just keep pushing them on it, because it's just different. It's just a different context. But the more you have those conversations, the better it's going to be. The worst thing you can do is not have the conversations. Yeah. And we talk as coaches, oh, that Billy over there, he thinks he's a superstar, taking all those bad shots, and his parents keep phoning. Man, we got to, you know. Go talk to Billy. Go talk to Billy's parents, and go talk to the coach. That's not easy for a lot of people, though.
But when you have this, like, IPP and so on, and in, like, a practice session, do you, like, address their anchors on limiting factors?
So pre-practice is a great time. The best pre-practices are where you have open gym, and there's not a team right before you. I went to a practice last night, and it was floorball. I mean, as soon as the clock went for floorball done, the basketball players are on the floor even before the floorball is off. And then soon as the girls' team was done, I mean, soon as the guys' team's on the floor. So you don't have time in that situation to do a lot of IPP before practice. But if there's time before or after, that's the first thing. What I do when I'm coaching a youth team in my junior academy, I build in times and practice for IPP work. And usually it's like, okay, this is for IPP, and I know what everybody's is. And mostly they want to work on their shooting one, but I may partner you two up. Why don't you two go down and work on your shot, because you both want to work on catch and shoots off pressure. Somebody run you off the line. Okay, you're going to work on that.
But do you have different stations?
Yeah, spread around the floor. Yeah. It might be that yours is working on your space pivoting, but I want to work on my ball defense. So, okay. Or I might even say, okay, we're doing three drills, and you choose which one. We got over here, we're going to play one-on-ones on the perimeter. Down here, we're working on boxing out, and over here, we're working on shots off the dribble. But I kind of know what they want, their IPPs. But then again, I may say, hey, this last 5 minutes is for your IPP. You go work on it. What do you want to work on? And if I want some help, we're here as coaches to help you. That's what we do a lot with the national team at the end of practice. We always give them time, and we know what their IPPs are. But it's all the most important part for us with national teams is talking with their coaches back home and getting some kind of agreement on this is what they got to work on. And that's how we have an impact on our players off national teams. And it's a huge part of it.
But do you give them, like, okay, this is some exercise, some drills you can do?
Yep. And with a lot of them now, because of video, like over COVID, man, video, show it to me. Send me, and I'd have players send me here's my workout I did today. And then if they ask, I'll give feedback. I don't give feedback unless they ask for it. I've learned that one. So I just don't start sending back a bunch of feedback. I wait till they ask. And then when they ask, now they've given me permission, and I'll give them some ideas.